Hey guys, welcome to episode 7 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I interview Peter Weiss. Peter is a therapist based out in Seattle, in America. He's an exceptionally nice guy. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. Now, Peter became known on a grand scale through his 2013 BBC documentary called Extreme OCD Camp. Now, it was him and another therapist called Travis Osborne. And what they did was they took six British teenagers to young adults out into the wilderness in Seattle and around those areas, and basically over 10 days helped them through ERP and other methods like acceptance start to overcome OCD. It's a phenomenal documentary. I'll put links on the website to it so you can check that out. It's on YouTube. Now, in this conversation with Pete, we talk about kind of what the documentary makers didn't show, the kind of behind the scenes, maybe some exclusives that he's never shared before in an interview. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was interesting to hear, especially having a background in media myself, how they went about it, and Pete's opinion and my own as well from watching it, that the BBC and the documentary team did a great job of actually showing what the reality of living with OCD is. Pete also talks about and explains some of the methods he used, him and Travis, in that documentary, and we just have a general discussion about OCD. I think you're going to love this. If you do, please leave a review if you can on iTunes, like it on YouTube, leave me a comment and I'll answer. Enjoy, and I'll speak to you soon. My guest today is Peter Weiss. Peter is a therapist who specializes in the treatment of obsessive compulsive disorder, as well as other mental health disorders. He is the founder of Blue Compass Camps and the OCD Camp. In 2013, the BBC made a documentary about his OCD camp, which featured six young adults from Britain. Pete is a member of the Association for Behavioural and Cognitive Therapies and the Obsessive Compulsive Foundation. Welcome to the OCD Stories podcast, Pete.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Cool. Did I say your surname right there?
It's Weiss.
Weiss.
But if I was in Germany, it would be Weiss.
That's what I thought. I swear the narrator in the BBC documentary said Weiss. Yeah.
I didn't even catch that.
Okay.
Either way,
I was going to ask if you had German roots. Okay, cool. So I always like to start the podcast with, you know, finding out if you had an OCD story or if not, so kind of like your general therapy story of becoming a therapist.
Well, I think I have both. I have what I would consider to be subclinical OCD. And it certainly informed my interest in working with this population. And I really didn't understand that I had even a smattering of OCD until I started treating it. And then I realized, wow, this is what's been going on with me. And it's a version that I've never heard before in my practice. In the fall, when trees lose their leaves, you have these very pokey, spindly branches. And I've had this intrusive thought for most of my life of imagining those branches kind of stabbing me in my eyes. And I think, you know, there was probably an event that occurred when I was young, growing up in Wisconsin, and I did a lot of sledding in the winter. And in our backyard, we had this huge hill, but it was in the forest. And so I'm sure that at some point I sledded into a tree and got poked in the eye. I don't have a conscious memory of that, but for whatever reason, that thought has stuck. And throughout my life, at different times, it's really bothered me. And it would get triggered if I see, you know, in the fall, if I see trees that are kind of particularly pokey. But also there was a period of time that I would just kind of lay down and go to sleep at night and close my eyes. And the second I would close my eyes, I would start having these thoughts. And the compulsion that I would do would just be to kind of rub my eyes or just work really hard to block out the thoughts. But sometimes it was pretty unbearable and I would lay awake for long periods of time. And not unlike some other people who first decide I'm going to go get some treatment, I had this thought that, you know, this is a weird thought, and I bet someone could just kind of trick it out of me. And so I thought, when I was in graduate school, I'd heard about this hypnotist in Seattle, and I thought that sounds interesting, and let's go to him and see if he could just hypnotize this out of me, which he attempted to do and failed. But it turned out to be a great therapy. Otherwise, we did a lot of other types of therapy as well. But it didn't really do anything for those thoughts. And then as I started seeing patients with OCD, I realized, oh gosh, this just has every quality of an OCD obsession. And so I essentially treated myself using ERP. And because it was subclinical, I could do that. I could do it really easily in some ways. Yeah. And you know, very much like other people with OCD, it's never gone away completely. And it's just mostly taken the really hard edge off of it. I no longer lay awake at night and having it be really bothersome. And sometimes I tell patients about this and sometimes I don't. It kind of depends on the person, but I often think about it and use that and helps me give some kind of deeper empathy and context to what's going on, knowing that what I'm experiencing is just a fraction of what someone with full-blown OCD has.
Yeah.
For the other part of the question around where I started in therapy, I started in wilderness therapy, working with clinical populations, what we were calling at that time hoods in the woods. And so we would take kids with behavior problems out on backpacking trips. And I just fell in love with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with the environment and using the environment to help them. And so it was through those experiences that I would hear them talking about their therapists back home. And actually, most of them would talk about them with a fair amount of, you know, compassion, that they liked them. They liked the experience. And I just thought, that's who I want to be. I want to get to know these kids on that kind of a level. Thinking probably I'll go to graduate school and then come back into the woods. And I realized that internships in the wilderness are really hard to find. And it's just hard to kind of fit it into your life. And so I started doing a really traditional internship where I'm in a small room with fluorescent lighting and doing therapy. But I fell in love with the work immediately. I think just because I enjoyed hearing people's stories and felt honored that they were letting me in. And it didn't matter if we were in the woods or if we were in a small office. We just needed some sort of safe space to have an authentic conversation. So that's how it all started. And a few years into it, I realized I wanted to get back into the woods. So I started some camps, and I was working with kids, lots of different types of kids, lots of autism spectrum, ADHD stuff, and also OCD. And I've since moved on from the autism and ADHD population. And kind of when it comes to wilderness, I focus just on the OCD camp. Yeah. And that came about when I was consulting with a prominent OCD expert in town, Stacey Shaw Welch, and her colleague, Travis Osborne. And, you know, they knew that I had run camps, and we kind of came up with this idea. Like, why not start an OCD camp? And I think this was in 2008. And so we did the very next year. And I think, I can't remember how many, this will be like 8 years or something this year. And we started mostly with teenagers. And then, but we'd sometimes have these outliers, these like early 20s that we would just kind of fit in. And then we realized we got to have an adult program. So now we do adults every other year and teens on the off years.
No, that's sorry, I drank my water way too quick. I did that on the last podcast as well. Before I would have learned by now. That's really interesting. I love the idea of taking kids or adults with mental health issues out into the woods, and because I love nature, I go camping as much as I can each year, and there's just something about just for anyone being kind of at one with nature. It realigns you. So I think that kind of experiential therapy is brilliant. Question that kind of stuck up for me there was, did you find that obviously being in the woods so much or the forests, that must have been ERP for you in itself, right? Because you would have been around the trees. Was that not so much because it might have been in the summer as opposed to the fall?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. And it kind of brings. I'll bring it back around to I think one of the dynamics of OCD. I don't think it actually triggers very much when I'm in the woods in that way. Walking, for example, if it's driving on a country road with lots of trees, that would be triggering. And there's something about the motion and the movement of the trees because it kind of, compels them to come into my eyeballs or something. But there's also, you have more control when you're walking. And OCD loves to put people in a place of being out of control. And so that's probably why it's much, much worse if I'm on a train or in a car or something like that. But if I'm just standing outside looking at a tree with no leaves on it, it's almost not a trigger at all because I feel like I have so much control. And then, of course, when I close my eyes, your imagination can just go anywhere. So that's probably why it's so bad at that moment.
No, that's interesting. I guess, as you say, OCD doesn't have to make sense and never does make sense. Okay, cool. There's always, I don't like to get into the stigma of OCD and stuff too much because I think it's better to focus on people's recovery. But out of curiosity, especially in the UK, there's always a lot of, there's these really crappy shows called like Obsessive Compulsive Cleaners and Hoarders, and obviously they're still to some degree conditions, but the media heavily labelled that that's exactly what OCD is, when obviously it's much broader than that. Were you happy with how the BBC finished the documentary and just showed it to the world?
I was. I had really low expectations, which was pretty terrifying, leading up to it. But as soon as we started the OCD camp, I think it might have been before we even did our first program, maybe it was the second year, we started getting calls from production companies. I think it was kind of, reality TV obviously was pretty set in stone in TV programming, but then the idea of introducing mental health issues in reality TV became like, oh, this is so brilliant. It's even more interesting. So it was kind of, we were just set up to get calls. And I just got the wrong vibe. I mean, to kind of put it simply from a lot of them, like, this is just going to be a sensationalized piece. And that's not at all what we wanted to do. And then I kind of jokingly say I got a call from Watershed Media, which was the production company that did it out of the UK. And I think it was the kind of disarming UK accent that kept me on the phone with one of their producers. And I just liked everything she had to say. She was clearly coming from a moral and ethical grounding that made me feel like, okay, that they're not just out there completely to entertain. I think that they want to educate. I think they actually want to help. And it was their idea to bring some young folks from young adults from the UK over. So that was their kind of whole twist on what they were doing, which I thought was a really interesting angle. And it certainly, made the program much, much different than it would have been should we have had just local people here. So in the end, to answer your question, I thought that they did a really pretty top-notch job. I think it was educational for a lot of people. I still get emails all the time from people around the world who really appreciated it because they saw themselves in those participants. That's ultimately what we wanted to do. But, you know, it wasn't up until we actually saw it that I was going to fully know what they were going to do with it. They didn't let us, you know, edit it, or, you know, we were completely out of that process. So I was quite nervous for a few months as it was being edited and put together.
I guess your whole career was on the line to some extent. No, I think it came across really well. I think it was one of the best, or if not the best thing I've seen on OCD in the media. And credit to the BBC. I don't usually give them credit, but they've done another documentary recently, which is more kind of, I guess not science. Yeah, I guess more based on the science behind it. But that was also pretty good. Okay, so just a brief question. How was it doing therapy while you were being filmed? Because it's one thing, you know, just you and a patient in a room, but with a camera in your face, it must have been quite a challenge.
It was kind of awful, actually, because therapy is such an intimate endeavor, right? It's all about being safe. And if you don't have a feeling of safety, it's really difficult to do. And so it was almost like, I don't know about the people I was working with, but I had to completely dissociate what was going on. I had to just pretend that it wasn't happening and just completely focus on the person. And you know, we split it up so that there were six participants, and Travis was assigned to three of them, and I had three of them. So I had Andrew, Jack, and Imogen. And all three of my people were great about that. They were able to kind of push it away too. And what I don't know if the BBC could capture, and I don't really care if they could or not, but we just had these moments of eye contact. Like, this is crazy what we're doing. This is absolutely nuts that you've just come across halfway around the world, and I've just met you, and I'm treating you for this thing that you've had most of your life, that you're desperately willing to get help from, to the degree which you will allow the world to watch your incredibly vulnerable process take place. And so it was such an honor to be able to be the kind of on the receiving end of that, but very much like, these people are so vulnerable and they're in my care. And ultimately, you know, I don't care what the cameras are doing. I don't care what people are going to think about this. My job is to treat this person, and I have 10 days to do it. It was just ridiculous, the setup, when you think about it. But maybe the intensity of all of that reality only enhanced it. Like, I think that maybe they had some empathy for me too. Like, Pete, I get it that this is kind of like high stakes for you. Not even like the idea, like, oh, my job is on the line here. I wasn't feeling too threatened by that. Maybe there was some sense of like, maybe people in the United States will never see this. So maybe I told myself that. But they were kind in that they allowed themselves to be vulnerable, and that's important in the work. I hope I did I answer your
Yeah,
question?
no, you did really well. And I guess, as you say, once you start, you realign with your purpose while you're there is to try and help them recover. I guess after a while, you must have just not ignored, but kind of blanked out the cameras because you were just focused on your job. Yeah, no, that's really good. So I got a couple user questions off Instagram. So the first one, her handle is @RareSerena. And she really loved the documentary, and she wants to know, you kind of answered this earlier, but what inspired you to help people with OCD? So I'll add to that, because you've already answered it, is in when you were helping Jack, I think when he was having harm OCD thoughts down by the dock or the pontoon, whatever it is. And obviously, when you were talking to the camera afterwards, you could tell you were upset and really kind of touched by his torment that he was going through. So I guess, is there any kind of deeper issues why, you know, that, or are you just generally naturally very empathetic and if that makes sense. It was a convoluted question. The second part to that was, is it common to have OCD with other mental health issues?
Yeah. So let me, I hear kind of three different questions. I want to address your the person that wrote in too, because I think I can add to what I said earlier, and then I'll talk about Jack and then comorbidities. So I think part of the intrigue of OCD treatment is that there's a huge metaphor in what we do, and that is that we're teaching people how to learn to live with risk and uncertainty. And that's pervasive, across all humans. It's not just for people with OCD. So I think the lesson that we're trying to teach is one that I'm still learning, will be learning my whole life, and I love to impart to others because life is scary. We're existentially scared most of our lives, and most of us are searching for some sense of safety and security throughout our lives too. And I want people to feel more safe, of course, but I also want people to be able to tolerate moments of not feeling safe. And OCD just takes what I just said and has its own flavor. It just has its own twist. So it's not that I'm just so concerned with just OCD, it's just one version of what I like to do on a more global scale, I think. As far as Jack in that moment, it's interesting that you ask about that. And I think Jack, maybe he'll hear this. I think he'll be okay with me saying this. I really hope so. I hope he doesn't get mad at me for this. But what you saw was a very small fraction of what really happened in a couple of hours of time. So, and I'm going to share what really happened. So we had been hiking in to this space and found this beautiful campsite, right? That was on the lake, and Jack had been having a really hard time the last couple miles getting into there because we're kind of walking along this cliff edge. So he's getting flooded with all these intrusive thoughts. And we kind of get into camp and he throws his pack off and he goes down to the dock. And I went and talked with him for a few minutes. But it was what was going on with Jack was it was like it wouldn't have been appropriate to film it. And so I said to Richard Cook, the director, I'm going to talk with Jack, but I need it to be off camera. And Jack was very, very willing for it to be on camera, but I just kind of used my clinical leverage to say no. I don't think we can get to where we need to get to if we're being filmed. And at first, he was upset about that because he wanted to really go all in and be vulnerable and express this to everyone, but I kind of said, yeah, it's a sacrifice maybe in that regard that people don't get to see this, but right now all I really care about is you. And so for an hour or two, Jack and I had an incredibly intimate conversation about him in the context of his world and what it meant to have OCD, but it was much more broad than that, and it was probably one of the most intense and defining moments of the whole 10-day trip for me. And kind of ironically, it wasn't caught on film, and I have no regrets about that whatsoever. But that's a moment, a kind of a therapy moment that I will never, ever forget. And Jack was so expressive about where he was in life and what brought him here to this moment. And it almost makes me emotional just to think of that right now. And I hope he feels similarly about it, that it was an opportunity to have a conversation about something that was really, really true to heart. So, that I guess what I'm just saying is the BBC and any kind of filming, you have to limit so much of what actually takes place. And even though they had hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage that they didn't add, they still didn't capture every little moment, right? Because sometimes moments are just a look, you know, or someone says something offhand and it means a lot, but you can't capture it on film. So again, to their credit for actually getting what they did and telling some version of a story. Then what was the third part? Oh, comorbidities, which are all the other things that could be going on with someone with OCD. So most people who have OCD have another diagnosis, a dual diagnosis or more. So I see a lot of people who also have generalized anxiety disorder. A lot of people with ADHD, autism spectrum, maybe other specific phobias, maybe trichotillomania, Tourette's, so that's hair pulling, skin picking, that kind of stuff, body repetitive disorders. And that's kind of the norm. Mm. It's actually exceedingly rare in my experience, and I think in the broader community, to see someone who just has OCD. I would say I've probably had maybe less than five patients in my career who just had OCD and they did not have meet criteria for another disorder. And let me tell you, they're super easy to treat. You know, it just goes in a number of weeks that you can do, you have a huge impact on their OCD symptoms. But people are complex, you know, we're pretty dynamic creatures. And when you have all these other things going on, you know, that's just what we got to deal with. So you're dealing with multiple balls in the air at once.
Cool. Yeah, no, that's a brilliant answer. I'm sure she'll love that. Okay, so one more user question. This is from overcoming_OCD. It's on Instagram. And he wants to know, we kind of touched on this again, but is the goal of your camps to kind of immerse people into an environment that's unfamiliar to them, that obviously exposes them to more risk, and I guess to have a greater impact on recovery in a shorter period of time?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't even know if I know the answer. It seems really obvious in some ways, like, oh, that should be the goal. And that's what we're doing, right? You know, like, we're going to go take these people and teach them how to be out of balance. It's certainly a piece of it. But I think there's so much to why we do this. And so I might go all over the place here and forgive me, but we're really talking about stuff that I could go on and on forever about. I think I often have to figure out what I think about human beings in my practice, right? Mm. And why we are the way we are, and why do we behave the way we do. And when I get confused, I think about primitive cultures. I think about when it was more simple times, and not that I can say that I've experienced this, but I can imagine what it was like, and I enjoyed studying about indigenous cultures. So, but let's just say that there's 20 people in a village, right? Mm. I make some assumptions about what happens in that village. One of them being that there's not a lot of mental health disorders, because a lot of people's needs are being met because it's such a small group, right? You're really thinking about, you know, food and shelter, and that's about it. But as far as getting along with each other, there's a lot of assumption that everyone's going to be getting along relatively well. Or if they're not, they have some way to work it out. So I think we're doing that a little bit when we go off to camp. We're kind of creating this little village. Mm. And there are about, I'd say, 15 of us. And we're in the woods for 3 days and 2 nights. And we sit around the campfire a lot and talk. So there's this all this kind of good ritual and tradition that gets created around eating and around ceremony. We kind of do the same things, same structure year after year, and everyone feels included in this, and everyone is honored. It's very much not a hierarchical, you know, Travis and I are running the show, and you're kind of going to do what we want you to do. Although we've provided structure, it's very much this kind of flat, even, we're all in this together. Travis and I share a lot about ourselves, way more than we do in our clinical practice. I should speak for myself. We've created this little community. Is that more significant therapeutically than the fact that we've kind of put people in this weird place and they have to use a portable bathroom and not shower for 3 days? I don't know. I would probably put my bet on the small community being a bigger, more curative factor.
Yeah.
Then we go and we do this high ropes course and everyone wonders, oh, like, are you expecting, like, if you go have people face their fear of heights, that's going to help their OCD? No, not really at all. I think it's more like, it seems like the thing to do. Might as well go do stuff that's kind of along the theme of taking risks. But could we be doing a different activity and have a similar impact? It's a great question that I don't have any context for because we haven't done anything else. But I like to think that I could create a similar experience. If you dropped off a group of us in downtown Seattle or anywhere at midnight and give us 24 hours, we will figure out an experience where we are working together and we're relying on one another and we're loving one another. And we're doing it in the context of, let's talk about OCD. Let's talk about how you guys all have this similar struggle in life. And we could have a really similar experience in 24 hours. So you got to have a group, got to have some sort of an activity basis. You need to have some amount of time, but it doesn't have to be a huge amount of time. Throw in some sleep deprivation. That's a great ingredient to this. Yeah. And one thing that you didn't see, well, you did see it in our behavior towards the end of the BBC. We were so ridiculously sleep deprived, it was like we were completely out of our minds. And in the end, when they give us the flag, do you remember that? We're sitting around the campfire and they Jack hands us.
The Union Jack.
Yeah. It was 5:30 in the morning and we had been up all night doing that group.
Jeez.
And we had gotten up the earlier morning at 5:30, way out in the woods. And so 24 hours of like complete madness, we were completely out of our minds. There was something really therapeutic about that. You know, there was something really important about that. I don't know if I would replicate it the same way again, but we were certainly in something together, kind of sharing some suffering with one another.
Yeah, no, that's really good to hear, actually. I like the bit about the high ropes because I've done that before. And I think it does, in a way, it does help because it's terrifying for a lot of people unless you're a real kind of thrill seeker. And at the end of it, you're always, the adrenaline's pumping, you're in a good mood. So I can see how doing ERP would be a bit easier after doing something like that. Because you just boost your self-esteem. And I think that showed with Andrew as well. Or that's how the BBC showed it.
Right. Well, they did some really clever editing with the whole high ropes. I mean, they really tried to enhance it as this thing that was really big and scary for everybody. And it was. And I have to admit, I think I've done so many high ropes courses, I'm totally desensitized to it. And so I appreciate you saying that because I think I forget how scary it is for people. And so, it is a metaphor and it is symbolic of like, this is life. We don't know exactly why, but we have to essentially force ourselves to be in this scary place. Otherwise, we shrink, you know, it shrinks our lives because we're spending all of our time trying to be safe.
Yeah.
I think about, The Aviator, the movie. Have you seen that with Leonardo DiCaprio?
No, I don't think I have.
Okay. It's a great symbol of what the extreme version of OCD can do when it really just shrinks someone's life into he basically died in a hotel room because he couldn't go out at all.
Yeah.
And that's, that unfortunately happens to some people, that fear envelops somebody to the point where they have a very limited life. And we're doing the opposite. We're trying to expand life.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, actually. Leonardo DiCaprio actually has OCD, doesn't he? Have you?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, because I've got his book here. Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz. Do you know
Okay.
he wrote Break. No, he didn't. He didn't write that one. He wrote You Are Not Your Brain and Brain Lock. I think he's a UCLA professor. I think he treated Leonardo DiCaprio. So on his website, he's got pictures with him and stuff.
Oh,
So
interesting.
if anyone knows Leo, I want him on the podcast. I think he's too busy in partying. A thing I noticed that you did really well in the documentary was how you dealt with people who are obviously heavily anxious, having panic attacks, or like with Andrew, who was depressed. And I guess for anyone listening who is friends of someone with OCD or a family member or I guess even therapists, because what's your advice on speaking to people who are heavily anxious? Because obviously in the moment they're not themselves. What's your kind of approach to dealing with them?
So if are you asking if someone's in the midst of a panic attack or in a really anxious space?
Yeah, so just not panic attack. Let's just say they're anxious, they're on edge. How would you kind of deal with them?
Sure. So one way to frame that is that when people are in that space, they're in a fight or flight space. And that's survival mode. You know, that's old primal brain. The amygdala are firing like crazy, and they're terrified. So anytime that any of us have been in a place where you're really, really scared, that's where you're at. So all you're thinking about is survival. So the number one thing is to get back to a place of safety. And if you're with someone who's in that space, then it's about being calm, slowing everything down, and helping people to feel like, hey, it's going to be okay. This is where reassurance can be a really good thing, and everything's going to be fine. And then allowing time to pass. But it's not just time. If you're talking about what can you do for a friend, it is about being kind of compassionately reassuring in that moment. It's not a time for processing, for problem solving, for rationalizing, like, no, that snake is actually not poisonous. It's not a time for that at all. It's all about, like, hey, let's get our brains back and calm down a bit first. Maybe 20 or 30 minutes later, then you can start talking about the reality of the experience or your perspective on the experience, but not in that moment.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice. Especially the bit I guess people were naturally going to go to wanting to give advice in that moment, and as you say,
Sure.
that's not the time.
Yeah.
That's very true. Okay, so for anyone who didn't watch the documentary, in it you have kind of a power motto, which you lay out at the start, which is maybe.
Yeah.
I guess could you just explain the thinking behind that, the purpose of it?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's never really expressed, and I don't think Travis Osborne, my friend who did this with me, I don't know if I ever expressed this, but I stole that from him. That's one of his things that he, when we were consulting on a case, he talked about. And you know, maybe did become a really big theme. And you know where I think it came from is really early on. We were in the bathroom, and I was doing the very first exposures with Imogen. And if you remember, Imogen had this awful intrusive thought that if she ate the wrong foods, that something awful could happen to her family. You know, she's a very smart young lady, and rationally gets, like, I know nothing's going to happen, but I have this awful thought. So this obsession was so intrusive and overwhelming that it was really kind of limiting her diet to a large degree. And kind of notably, when she couldn't eat M&Ms. It's like, that's awful that you can't eat M&Ms. So, So we started with the M&M, and with exposure, we go as slow and gradual as we possibly can. So I knew she wasn't going to be able to eat an M&M. We couldn't even crush up an M&M at the beginning and have her try to eat a little bit. Yeah. So we just started with her holding it against her cheek. So even holding an M&M up against her cheek would cause anxiety, and I thought this is a great place to start.
Yeah.
I don't know if you see that in the BBC or if she had already moved on to
her lips.
Yeah. But I don't think that you catch this really in the show, but what she did is she held it up to her lips and then she said out loud something like, "But I know my family's going to be okay." So what was going on there is she had just done an exposure, a planned exposure that we had tried to do have her do, and she did that very well. But what happened was OCD crept in and snuck a compulsion in. And that's what OCD does, right? It has this feedback loop of doing the compulsions to make yourself feel better. And in really good therapy, we want to remove those extraneous compulsions and be on the lookout for them as much as possible. So she does the exposure. Awesome. That's fantastic. We just kind of want her to sit and live with that anxiety and tolerate that. But then she says, "But I know that they'll be okay." And that's where it's like, do we need to talk about that? And we did. And we started talking about, could you say, can you introduce doubt here? Can you tolerate a little bit of uncertainty of maybe thinking, I don't know actually 100%. Maybe I'll be 99.9% certain that they'll be fine, but I can't prove it, yeah. Right? My mom might have just stubbed her toe 2 seconds ago. We just don't know. And that's where the maybe thing comes in. And I guess I had brought those. We gave out those little question mark tattoos, which became kind of like a logo for what we were doing. And it's sometimes I use them in therapy because it's a great way to put it on the back of your hand or something to remind you to do maybe a mental exposure or something like that. Maybe it got overemphasized. It's probably more focused on than I actually do in my actual practice. It's a concept that I introduce some of the time, but it's usually with mental compulsions like Imogen's that kind of creep back to where we have to start to introduce some doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's good to hear actually. And you took my next question, which was about the tattoos.
Okay.
Cool. Now that's really interesting. And it somewhat reminds me a lot of ACT or acceptance and commitment therapy, which is obviously,
yeah.
Yeah, obviously accepting the thought and adding a bit of that uncertainty in. Do you do any ACT, or is it purely sort of CBT?
Yeah, absolutely. It's. I think it gets interwoven. I think I sometimes I lose the forest through the trees of what exactly I'm doing. But ACT has got some really important salient points to it that I think really enhances exposure therapy.
Yeah.
I think the one thing that I'm starting to notice myself, and I've noticed this all along, that I think ERP isn't the whole package. And this might feel a little bit disconcerting to some, maybe therapists who are really bought into it, because I'm pretty bought into it. It's a tool, and it's a highly, highly effective tool. And I think if someone's getting OCD treatment and there's no exposure involved, I think it's a disservice. I think it's pretty vital.
Yeah.
But there's a huge caveat. There's a huge but there that tools are limited and they only go so far. And what I'm finding more and more is the importance of the therapeutic relationship and maybe what some would consider, you know, older theories of therapy, even Freudian and psychoanalytic thinking, psychodynamic thinking, that I think maybe it's not acknowledged enough in the land of OCD treatment and CBT. There's just all this focus on the importance of ERP, And again, that will get people functioning. But what I've had happen time and time again is, yeah, I'll get people back into school, back to work, back to a level of suffering that they can tolerate a lot more than they could before they came to see me. Yeah. But then there's everything else in life, you know, there's the everything else about being human. And I think therapy doesn't end when ERP ends. I think in some ways it's just starting. I think ERP is kind of the easy part. There's so much more to it than that. And that really comes from this loving, compassionate relationship with a therapist. So when you were going to, you know, you proposed to interview me, I thought I got to slip that in because this needs to be talked about more. Yeah. I don't know if you saw, there was an article earlier this month in The Guardian about CBT and Freud.
No, I missed that.
I can send you the link. Yeah, I could look it up really quick just so your listeners could.
Oh, I'll put it in the show notes afterwards.
Okay. Yeah. Oliver Berkman. Cool. I had it open. So was the author was earlier this month. And basically it's just about that efficacy studies on CBT are starting to not be so bright and shiny. You know, CBT has really great impacts in some ways, and there's been a ton of research on it to the degree that in the United States, they're limiting the amount of funding they even give out anymore because it's like, yeah, we know that works. But how well does it work, you know, as far as longevity and what all is it doing? So, again, it's a piece of the puzzle, but there's a lot more to it. And I really think it has to do with human relationships.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I'll check out that article as well, but I fully agree. CBT is great. ERP is really good. But it's almost, in some way, it feels like we've kind of settled for something that works fairly well. And we've kind of taken our foot off the pedal. Instead of thinking, well, it's not working every time and that's an issue, which is why I like the work Stephen Hayes and his team and everyone else who's researching ACT. I think that's showing incredible results in research. Obviously, there's other therapies coming through. And for me, other things like nutrition played a huge part in my recovery. Obviously, exercise, meditation was massive. So, yeah, all these things that it's a real holistic approach.
Yeah.
As you say, yeah, ERP is amazing and it helped me a lot. But it, as you said, it was kind of the beginning. But yeah, cool. All right. So we've answered a few of these here. Oh, actually, so when Travis was helping Josh across the lake, I think it was quite at the start of the documentary, Travis was having a conversation with him, basically what looked like helping him size up the task. Because he knew it might freak Josh out going on this raft where he'd be trapped for however long it took to cross the lake. How important is that, I guess, from an ERP point of view, before you do an exposure, to just take a second and think and almost mentally rehearse what's going to happen or prepare yourself? Is that really important for big exposures?
Oh, that's a great question. I can't honestly remember exactly that conversation that he was having. As far as I remember the raft thing, it was kind of like the ropes course in that it was kind of less of a big deal than they made it out to be.
Really.
Josh had some, I mean, he's an amazing guy who had some pretty incredible, inspiring moments where he pushed himself. That they didn't catch, you know, because they can't catch everything. So I almost kind of want to just not speak to it because I don't think in my recollection, it just wasn't that big of a deal for Josh. But I also can answer your question that the basis for all therapy, including ERP, is that you have to have this foundation of safety and security first, right? That's why we say you got to have rapport with the therapist and the patient. And so Travis was probably doing a little bit of that, like just basically saying to Josh, hey, just so you know, I'm here and I'm with you and I'm going to take care of you. Mm-hmm. And let's talk through this a little bit before we go do it. You know, visualization can be hugely helpful sometimes. So maybe it was a little bit of that. But I could speak to another moment that they didn't catch that was incredible with Josh, that, you know, when you talk to Travis about it, it brings tears to his eyes, that, you know, Josh is all about evening things out, right? And when he had a really unique response to being anxious, and that was, he literally, his capacity to be verbal was reduced. He couldn't speak when he was in a flooded state.
Yeah.
So we were doing some activity in this lodge where everyone would stand up and speak about something. I can't remember what it was. And we had some little platform. And the platform was right in between Travis and I, and we were sitting next to it. And it was a really kind of high platform. And again, what they were sharing is irrelevant. It's the fact that Josh gets up there and he starts talking and he's sharing. And this is all like, you know, people are just so authentic and genuine in this moment. He's sharing this and he leans over and he gives Travis a high five and does not even it out and keeps talking. And you could tell it's like, you know, he's like running through mud or something, but he didn't have to do that. You know, no one was saying, we weren't doing exposures at that time, but he completely embraced this moment of like, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to go for this right now. I'm going to be vulnerable. And it was beautiful. It was an amazing thing. It's, they couldn't have caught it because they wouldn't have understood what was going on. But I'd say that was one of my highlights when I think about Josh for his experience.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. And it's like he's attacking it, right? He's got that growth mindset, and that's a beautiful thing. No, that's really good to hear, actually. Getting a lot of behind-the-scenes exclusives. Okay, so with Andrew, he obviously had a lot of low self-esteem, and I guess that can be make it incredibly hard for you to see, and if you're depressed as well, to try and recover, because you're almost from a mindset of what's the point? So obviously you were heavily tasked to try and help boost that self-esteem, I guess, before you could do the therapy to some degree, as in ERP and stuff like that. What sort of things were you doing to help boost his low self-esteem? I know you said when you got him to raise his voice, because he had insecurities around his voice, that you said, what was it? I hope you're just, if there's a proud feeling in there that you know, you feel it, even if it's small. Is it just little things like that to boost self-esteem, or?
You know, Andrew is a great example of where ERP falls short. You know, if I was treating Andrew, we wouldn't do ERP for months, maybe not years into therapy, because there was so much more to what was going on with him than that tool would work for. So, you know, it was kind of like, this is a ridiculous thing that we're doing this therapy because he needs so much more time because of his feelings about himself. And, you know, I guess I can shed some light on something that will better articulate what I'm trying to say. So we did a 10-day program with Andrew. Some amount of time right after that, maybe like a month later, I was running my other camps, one of which was a young adult camp. And for young adults with Asperger's and high functioning autism. Well, we sent Andrew on that. So Andrew came back to the US and we sent him on a 3-week long backpacking trip with, there was maybe 8 other young adults with Asperger's. Yeah. And I asked him after that experience, which of the two experiences helped with your OCD more? And he said the second one. Wow. No ERP treatment whatsoever on that second one. The staff that led that trip were staff that I hired, but that was not the focus of the program. And so it's things like that that shed a little bit of light on, you know, what it means to get better from OCD. And for some people, it's not about just doing a ton of exposure. It's about focusing on other parts of your life that are important. Like in Andrew's case, relationships. Mm. What was helpful about that program for him is he got to be seen. He got to exist in the eyes of others, outside of his family, and felt this really loving group environment for 3 weeks that was really torturous to end. You know, it was really hard for him to leave, as it would be for anybody. That was hugely helpful and reduced his OCD symptoms greatly. Wow. Now, does exposure still help him in the concepts of it? Yeah, I think so. He's told me that. Yeah. And I think he's still, you know, struggling with it to some degree. But here's a kid who he needed to get out of his house and engage in life.
Yeah.
So when I was working with him, you know, that first scene where you see it, I kind of hate it because they keep, I don't know if it was like in the, you know, they're going to commercial break and then they repeat me saying something like that just sounds mean to him. It's like, maybe your voice does sound stupid or something. and it was like, oh God, that just sounds awful. Like it takes it out of context and it just sounds mean. And I think in that moment, what was going on for me is I was so frustrated with the fact that I was learning about the depth of Andrew's issues while on camera, you know, right at the beginning of this. And it was kind of like, we don't really need to be doing exposures with this kid. And we didn't. We did very, very few exposures throughout the 10 days. And Richard Cook, the director, kept being like, Pete, when are you going to do exposures with Andrew? Like, it's part of the story. We have to do exposures. And I kept trying to impart, that's not what it's going to be about for him. It's about him being involved in this group and having some friends. You know, that's what it's all about for him. And I think that's where he got a lot out of it.
Yeah.
He's a smart guy. He gets the concept of exposure and stuff. So I don't know if I answered your question there, but it was complicated to say the least.
No, yeah, you did. It's great to hear that you went on another camp and it really helped him. I did really like Andrew. I think you could tell he's a very sincere and genuine person. So it's great to hear.
And he would speak truths about what was going on for him and for the group that other people couldn't articulate. But when he would say it, everyone would kind of be blown away. Like, yeah, but what he said. So he was such an asset to have with us.
Yeah, that's brilliant to hear. Okay. Actually, this isn't really a question. I just wanted to mention it. The sort of bear metaphor that you did with that, the chef in that restaurant, where he was preparing the glass for Jack, and you said, "What's your biggest fear?" And he said, "Probably, you know, bears." And you said, "Well, imagine what you'd feel like getting in a cage of a bear." And he's like, "Well, I wouldn't." And you were obviously, "Well, that's how he's feeling now, just getting this glass." And I think when people hear that, it shocks them, but also in a good way, it makes them think, "Wow, that's terrifying if they're going through that." And I think that's the best way I've ever heard it sort of expressed.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't see the pain in someone's head.
Right.
Like even if you see them having a panic attack, to some degree, you still don't get it, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Right. And it was kind of it was a neat moment because I had just met that guy 30 seconds before we started filming that. You know, they all knew we were here and they're doing some OCD thing. And, you know, half the people are like, "What's OCD?" And so very quickly, I needed to explain to this guy why I'm interrupting his work that he's got to get done and make sense of this really, really fast. And he was a great guy that could get that. really quickly. He really fully understood it. And so it was kind of like more of a gesture to him than to anything else. I think that they just kind of ran with it and realized, oh, this would be a great way to teach the viewers about what this is all like, because there's probably thousands of viewers that are like, what's going on? And you saw that in the comments of the
Oh, really?
YouTube video. Oh, like half the people are like, why can Jack get tattoos, but he can't drink out of a glass? And it's like that's not new to Jack at all. He could see that coming. And that's one of the reasons we did the program, and hopefully some people started to see, oh, okay, like people can have other thoughts than the way I think about things.
Yeah, that's the thing. As I said earlier, OCD doesn't make sense. And for me, I've got quite a lot of tattoos, and needles don't bother me from that point of view. But if it was an injection needle, I would heavily worry about contamination and things like HIV and other stuff like that. My mind would go off on a on a on a ask the word, it would just run off of itself. But obviously, with tattoos, it's never once crept into my head. And it's because OCD doesn't make sense. Whereas,
And it's one thing for someone to not understand. It's another thing for someone to discount how you're feeling. That's where it really becomes a problem. Like, you're not actually, I'm going to discount what you're saying. It's not valid. And that's where I think it becomes pretty damaging for people, especially younger folks.
I 100% agree with that. I just want to check on time. Have you got a little bit more time?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Cool. All right. So again, going back to sort of, I guess any therapists listening as well, but also any family members of people with OCD or friends, how do you deal with, as a therapist, the kind of transfer of anxiety? Because obviously, if you're around anxious people all day, it's natural you're going to pick up on some of that. What are your tips for sort of not letting it get to you? And if that makes sense.
Well, maybe I'll put this in the context of like a parent-child relationship when a child has OCD, because there's so many questions for parents about how to handle that. And no parent, I'm a parent, I've got two young daughters, and so I get that, the primary thing that I'm always thinking about are my kids okay? Are they feeling okay? If they're distressed for any reason, then immediately you want to kind of do something about that and help them with that. And the brutal thing about OCD and parenting a child with OCD is that there's not a really clearly defined path on how to do that. And then it gets even more complicated when a therapist is saying, look, all of these things, we call these family accommodation behaviors, all the things that parents might do to kind of be a helper to OCD. Like, for example, I had a 11-year-old girl once who had to use a tremendous amount of shampoo. So I don't know how many times the dad had to go to the store mid-shower to get another bottle of shampoo. And this is, they would already buy shampoo by the case. And so that would be a family accommodation behavior where they're really spending a lot of time and energy helping out OCD. And at some point in therapy, that needs to be removed. Ideally, not initially, it's kind of a later stage change, but it still needs to happen sooner or later. And it's really difficult to ask a parent to do this counterintuitive thing where I'm actually going to do something that's going to cause my kid more pain and suffering. And even though it was bad before, I knew I wasn't supposed to, at least I could help them. I could go to them and soothe them. So that's probably one of the most difficult things about parenting or living with a kid with OCD is to do that. I don't know if it completely addressed what you were asking about, but I think I see that more than this contamination of anxiety, which I'm sure could happen too.
Does that so from a therapist point of view, does it not kind of obviously it phases you to the point you feel compassion for the person in front of you, but does it ever, I don't know, if you've been around, say, five patients who have been heavily anxious all day, and Does that rub off on you at all? Or are you quite good at kind of keeping, not your shields up, but you know what I mean, protecting yourself from that?
Yeah, you know, like a paramedic metaphor comes to mind really quick. You know, that they probably see all sorts of blood and guts, and they can just sleep relatively well at night. I think to some degree that happens because I do remember being an intern and feeling like I could barely sleep. You know, there was
Yeah.
just so much going on, and so I think that as therapists, we learn to compartmentalize and leave it at work. And there's also a huge amount of self-care, you know, our own therapy at times, and trying to figure out how to have some sort of work-life balance. All of those things are crucial.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you just kind of figure out how to tolerate it over time too.
Yeah, that's a good point. My mum's a nurse, and she now works with people in, I don't know if you guys in America use the word hospice as well, which is usually for people, yeah, usually for people who are not always, but usually going to die because it's terminal illnesses and stuff like that. And so she sees death a lot. And when I've asked her about this was 10 years ago, I said, "Doesn't it bother you, or doesn't it faze you that you carried out a dead person last night?" And she's just like, "No." Continued eating her dinner, and it just seemed like the weirdest thing to me at the time that she was absolutely fine with it. Like, she's obviously numb to it or get used to it, and it didn't faze her. Cool. So, you there? Sorry, I thought it froze then. Okay, so we touched on that. I wanted to touch on this idea of, a lot of people I speak with have depression alongside OCD. I had sort of a mild depression. I wouldn't ever say it was really, really bad. But I know that any form of depression alongside OCD is a nightmare. But obviously, if you're clinically depressed as well, then that's just, yeah. I guess what are the kind of challenges facing someone who has depression with OCD, and kind of what advice would you give them to kind of, I don't know, make it easier to deal with, or yeah, any advice really?
Depression and OCD are close cousins. They get along really, really well together. And it's no coincidence that SSRIs are the number one prescribed medication, and they're used for antidepressants as well. And it's a little bit of an issue of the chicken, or the egg, which came first to some degree. Because I see it go both ways. I see people who are really in a depression who start to have more OCD symptoms. And I also see people have a huge amount of OCD symptoms, then becoming depressed because of that. And this kind of really goes back to and highlights my point about the limitations of ERP. I think I treat depression, kind of the first line depression, with, let's get your head above water to some degree. And a lot of that is more global, holistic lifestyle choices, like you were saying, diet, sleep, and exercise. All of those things gotta be attended to pretty early on, because it's really hard to do all the other work when you don't have the fuel or the brain capacity because you're sleep deprived to do so. And again, I get it that, sometimes people just can't sleep because they're so depressed. But they need to be talked about and attended to initially. And then I think the question is really about a broader conversation about all the things that come up when someone's depressed. Sometimes people just feel depressed and they feel like I shouldn't, my life's all lined up, this doesn't make sense. But also oftentimes I think that there are things that are going on in life that make it a lot worse. So even if someone has kind of a baseline level of depression, there are circumstances in life that are just exacerbating it. So that's a lot of what gets talked about too. So I guess the to summarize what I'm saying is that I'm using broader brushstrokes when it comes to lots of depression being involved as well.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, that I agree with that. The depression's there. It's a lot harder to treat OCD from my own experience as well. Cool. What's kind of the future for OCD camps? Is it keep them going as they are, or is there any opportunity? Are you looking to expand them, or not say franchise them out, but encourage others to do it?
Oh, I would love it if other people would do it. There's a couple hospitals on the East Coast that have they've either tried or are doing it, and I would love to see that evolve. I just read an article somewhere in the Southwest that someone's trying to do some wilderness therapy around it. As far as I know, we've been doing it kind of the longest and the most consistently, and I would love to see this grow. I don't think it takes this massive, huge, specialized skill set to pull it off. So I don't think we're limited in that regard. As far as how much time and energy we're going to put it into, the idea of 3 days really came down to Travis and I having a conversation around how can we fit this into our lives. Yeah. It was very much a conversation about we want this to happen, we want it to be sustainable, but we want our partners to still love us. That's how we came up with it. And I all the time am thinking about what more could we do? And it's an alluring thought. It's like a seductive thought of what more we could do, because I got an email a couple months ago from somebody in Fiji who was saying, can I come to the camp? And we have a wait list for this summer's camp, and we haven't even started screening yet. And they're from all over the world. Yeah. And I get it that for some people, traditional, you know, in-office clinical therapy doesn't work. It just doesn't fit. Hospitalization doesn't fit. The options that, if you're lucky enough to be close to them, aren't working. But there's something intriguing about coming to camp. Yeah. And having that resource accessible for more people would just be fantastic. And part of the struggle is how do you get the therapists who are going to carve it into their life, you know? Yeah. And how are we going to do that? It's really tough doing it with you know, having a family and having to balance that all out. But one of the things I learned about the BBC program is that 10 days really seems to be kind of like in my mind, a magic number. Yeah. I think we could do a very similar program to what we did and actually make it a clinical treatment program and get a huge amount done in 10 days. And hospitalization, as it stands now, is a lot longer than that. I mean, you're talking maybe a month, two, maybe more. It has a huge amount of potential. It's just more about timing. And when is it going to fit in?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's great.
If you want to start with the UK, I'll tell you everything that we do.
That's good. Well, Joe, I was thinking that as you were talking. I was like, I love camping. I'd love to help people with their OCD. I just need to find a therapist, and then I can use this platform I've got to maybe get it going. So it's something I'll leave in my subconscious, and if it comes up again, then, you know, I'll leave it with the universe. Cool. So if you had to give one piece of advice, I know this is a tough one, but one piece of advice, you have 30 seconds, you met someone with OCD, what's that one piece of advice you give them? You're never going to see them again.
Do they live in a major metropolitan area that has access to services, or do they live in rural Kansas?
Let's go.
I need some context.
All right. Let's go. They live in a city, big city.
Then it would be to go to the International OCD Foundation website and see if there's a provider. And even if they have to drive a couple hours, it's still worth it to start off. If proximity is an issue, then Skype therapy, I think, is better than none. I think you can get a lot done over Skype. I guess maybe for any of them, I would send them to that website too, because I think that, you know, one of the primary things that we do at the camp is provide normalization. That's what we realized after the first year. It wasn't a treatment program. We didn't really set out for it to be, but the biggest thing we could offer is, hey, you're not alone in this world. This is not just you, and especially for teenagers, it's such a secretive disorder. People just feel like, oh my gosh, like there's no way anyone else thinks like this. And then to hear other people tell your story is a really wonderful feeling. So people can get that by just going to the website and starting to learn and educate themselves. I think maybe now I would send them to your site as well. I mean, I think what you're doing is fantastic, and sites like this and programming like this are absolutely crucial. Because we just know it's not, we're not going to zap this. Maybe we will someday. Maybe we'll laser it out of our brains. But I'm dubious about that. I think that, you know, life is supposed to be difficult in some ways, and this is just one way that it could be difficult. But we don't have to go through that alone.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice. And actually, what you were saying about getting it lasered out, something I've been thinking about a lot recently. I've had a few people ask me questions about various new surgeries to do with OCD, and I kind of the question of like, if you feel you have to, but with surgery, we're almost robbing people of the opportunity they have to become an awesome human being. And facing OCD is going to teach you so much more than never having to struggle. And yeah, I guess, yeah, it's a hard thing to say, but it's like, yeah.
So this is a very North American thing for me to say, but I would just high five you if I could right now. If
Sure.
Richard Cook, the director, ever sees this, he'll laugh because we were always high fiving, and he was like, "Oh my God, you're just such archetypical Americans." But I completely agree with that sentiment that if we could laser it out, I don't know if I would want to. I just had a conversation with an OCD patient last week about all of the great things about her OCD and what it provides for her. And sometimes it's impossible. It's so interwoven. It's impossible to separate the parts of oneself that are OCD-like that they like and that they're proud of and they feel good about, and the parts of OCD that make them cringe. And is a laser going to know exactly precisely where to do that? I don't know. Someday, but it almost sounds like it's way less interesting if they could.
Yeah, that's true. And obviously, if they could just laser out just the OCD part, they're still leaving low self-esteem, they're still leaving low confidence, and treatment of OCD will, to some degree, treat those things as well. And this Stephen Hayes talked about this. He said, you know, if you have a mental health difficulty, you're the lucky one. And it was a bold statement, but I guess he can make it. And I remember reading, okay, Lance Armstrong's probably a bad example now, but you know what he did, regardless of drugs, was still incredible. But in his first book, he got an email from a cancer survivor after he recovered, and the guy said to Lance, he said, "We're the lucky ones." And it's slightly different context to mental health, but what he meant was they now see the importance of life. They need to now see how precious it is, and they can live each day like it was their last. Whereas, you know, people haven't necessarily faced that. A lot of times I live my life kind of, I guess, sometimes wasting it away because I forget how finite my life is. Not in a morbid way, but in a precious way, and somewhat similar with mental health.
I like it. I like what you have to say. I think you could make a hell of an OCD therapist.
Wow,
You've got some good stuff.
cheers, man. That's the long term goal for me, anyway. It's just a nightmare transitioning careers from marketing to obviously therapy. You've got to go through various bodies. The UK's a nightmare for it. Anyway, maybe we can talk about that later. I don't want to bore
There's
everyone else.
probably more parallels than we could both imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Okay, cool. So you have a billboard anywhere in the world you want. It doesn't have to be OCD related, but what would you have written on that billboard for the world to see?
I would quote the Beatles, and it would just say, "All you need is love."
Yeah, that's brilliant. I thought you were going to say, "Let it be."
It could say that too, but I it hasn't all already come out ringing true. I think as a I don't know, sentimental as it sounds, I think that the healing nature of human relationship is paramount to everything that we do. And in the BBC program, that's probably what it all came down to, is that it was an incredibly loving environment that we were all a part of, and we cared for each other deeply, and that's probably all that mattered. Technique, ERP, whatever, put that all aside, and I think we still would have had a pretty incredible experience.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that shows so much in the OCD community in general, and maybe across other mental health communities, but especially in OCD. If you put like pay attention on Twitter, there's so much support, and that I can go on and know like 50 other people I've never met in my life before I even started OCD Stories, and they knew what I was going through. I knew what they're going through. We help each other. And I see this all the time, and it's such a beautiful thing to see random humans come together and have so much compassion for each other. And I think that's the main benefit that all OCD sufferers get, or a lot, is this huge sense of compassion and understanding of others' pain. Yeah, and I think if we can help OCD sufferers recover, I think we're empowering wonderful human beings. Yeah. Maybe I'm just trying to flatter myself, but it's yeah, I
How
know
about
it's
yours? Your billboard be?
my billboard. Jesus. You would have thought I would have thought about this. Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I love quotes, so there's like a million running through my head and I can't think of one. Probably something like "You're good enough."
Yeah.
Because I know a lot of people suffer with self-esteem, and I haven't to some degree. There's still times when I don't feel I'm good enough, and yeah, or you are enough. Yeah, I think that's it. There you go.
I like that one, and it's interesting the differences in UK culture and US culture. This is a long shot and dangerous for me to say, but in America, we do not have any good concept or rational concept of what enough is. It is pervasive in our culture. It's toxic. It's corrupted. And I guess I can't say I've never been to the UK. I don't
Yeah, I'd
know
say
it
it's
well,
very
but
similar.
yeah. And
Yeah.
maybe it is to some degree a US global epidemic, but certainly we have it really bad here. And so that corrupts how we think about ourselves too, because we're getting the message that maybe we're not enough all the time.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I was in China September last year. Yeah. And it was obvious that Western cultures, I almost want to say, poisoning their traditions, and they're becoming a lot more like us in terms of just consuming, and there seems to be no end to it. And I think consuming of physical goods relates to kind of mental health to some degree, because you're consuming all other emotions and you're not truly valuing anything. Yeah, cool. Yeah, I mean, we're getting almost political rants now.
I like it.
Yeah, we'll talk about Donald Trump next. Are you a Trump voter? You
Think
can't
that
say.
should, hopefully that's really obvious.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, cool. So how can people find out more about you or get in contact if you want them to?
People can I think you can just Google me. Just if you just do a Google for Pete Weiss Seattle therapist or something like that, I'll probably pop up. Or the OCD camp is teenocdcamp.com, I believe. And so you can find me through there as well.
Yeah, well, I'll put all the links in the show notes on the OCDstories.com site.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your time, Pete. It's been an enjoyable conversation. I've learned a lot, and it's been good to hear about the kind of behind the scenes of what went on. Yeah, definitely
Great.
get.
Thank you so much, Stu, for everything that you do and that you're putting this out there. And I just appreciate that you're going way beyond yourself to help others. I think your goal is a very noble one.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we'll get you on again soon.